This is Intercom Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Welcome again to the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast for our 39th episode. For today's episode of the podcast, we look at a report in the JCENM that gives us new information on the changes in size and shape of the pancreas in type 1 diabetes. In diabetes care and research, we lack a clear understanding of the pathophysiology and progression of type 1 diabetes, and this study promises a deeper understanding of these processes. As is usually the case for papers we review, the authors employ an observational study design. Such studies come with intrinsic limitations that need to be considered, so we will carefully walk through the methodology used and how that impacts the conclusions the authors draw. I continue to be lucky enough to host the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast, though spending most of my time as a general endocrinologist at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center, where I also work as a medical director and associate director for our fellowship program. An adult and a pediatric diabetologist joined me for today's episode to dissect this article. Ashok Balasubramanian returns to our virtual recording studio as our regular contributor for this month. He works at the Baylor College of Medicine, where he is a vice president and senior associate dean for their medical school, as well as the director of their clinical scientist training program. He is well known for his translational research in diabetes, particularly atypical diabetes, as well as for being the chair of the endocrinology specialty board for the ABIM. Taylor Triolo joins us today as our guest expert. She is a pediatric endocrinologist at the University of Colorado. Her clinical care focuses on diabetes, and her research centers on autoimmunity and prevention of type 1 diabetes. As you can easily tell, the perfect pair of endocrinologists has joined me for the podcast. As is also always the case, everything we say will be our opinions only and not those of the Endocrine Society or of our respective institutions. Today, we look at longitudinal MRI shows progressive decline in pancreas size and altered pancreas shape in type 1 diabetes. This manuscript is forthcoming in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. Jordan Wright at Vanderbilt University and Aidan Delaney at the University of Texas at Austin served as first authors for this paper. I'll note that several of my colleagues here at Vanderbilt contributed to this study, and so we'll be sure to say a few particularly harsh things in an attempt to prove that I am not biased in favor of them. Now I will turn things over to Ashok. He will hit some of the key points that the authors make in their introduction, in addition to having Taylor expound on key background information that we need to understand. Ashok?
Hello, Chase. Thanks for having us discuss this really interesting article. And I think the broadest aspect of the background is that, unlike physicians in most other specialties, we are in endocrinology and diabetes are handicapped by the fact that the most essential organ to the pathophysiology of the disease we treat, diabetes, is virtually inaccessible. And it's particularly inaccessible to any kind of imaging. So I'm talking about the islets of Langerhans, you know, several hundred thousand cells scattered in little bundles across the exocrine pancreas. And to date, there is no clinically useful way to visualize them. And it's very, very hard to biopsy them. Therefore, in life, it's really hard to know what's happening in this very essential organ. Most of our data comes from autopsy studies, which of course tells you nothing about the natural history of what happened to that little essential organ through life. Now, it's turned out that, interestingly, that somehow at least the size and shape or volume of these islets may be reflected in the overall size and shape of the entire pancreas. Now, why that is and how that is certainly something that's worth discussing, but it's a useful thing to hang on to in terms of coming to us as a visual aid for the diagnosis and the prognosis of different forms of diabetes. So the first issue is that we have this important organ. It's very hard to visualize. This paper focuses on a way to try to look at a surrogate kind of visualization. And I'll pause at this point and ask Taylor, as a type 1 diabetes expert, what she feels about the aspects of type 1 physiology that may actually have a relationship to the size and shape of the overall pancreas or of the islets.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me today. So type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease that is preceded by a preclinical period where autoantibodies develop against insulin-producing beta cells. And this time of progression from onset of detectable islet autoantibodies to progression to clinical disease can be really variable from person to person. And we don't have, other than autoantibodies, great biomarkers or ways to know that this progression is continuing on in a person who might be at risk for development of type 1 diabetes. I think there's a lot to be gained from this study in terms of new and innovative ways that we can understand progression in those who might be at risk for developing type 1 diabetes.
And so coming to the point of, well, how does the imaging of the pancreas helps? It turns out that the past studies that have done a cross-sectional analysis in patients with type 1 diabetes have revealed that they may actually have a smaller pancreata, than age-matched non-diabetic persons. And there's also a suggestion that this is mostly due to the loss of the acinar cells, which it raises a lot of questions. Why is it smaller? What is the connection of the acinar cells being smaller or less in number to the changes in the islets of Langerhans? Moreover, the data has not been cleaned to date because correlations between these cross-sectional data and such important epidemiological aspects as the duration of the disease or the course of the disease have been fairly conflicting. So it's very important to have well-done studies of this phenomenon of change in the size of the pancreas, and especially to have them done in a longitudinal fashion. So again, I'd like to ask Dr. Triolo, what do you think are the reasons for the loss of overall pancreas volume in type 1 diabetes?
I think at this point, it's hard to know what are the relationship between the acinar cells and the beta cells and why decline in acinar cell number and the volume overall might then contribute or trigger autoimmunity. Perhaps the underlying environment for the islets around the acinar cells could contribute to risk for beta cell inflammation or destruction and thus triggering an autoimmune response. But I think the study really is helpful in looking at the heterogeneity in this disease, because I think this development of autoimmunity and progression from these preclinical autoantibodies to decreasing pancreas volume and development of type 1 diabetes, all of these aspects are probably contributing to each other, but we still just don't know how they interrelate to each other.
Thanks, Dr. Triolo. And I think that basically what you're saying is that this is an important topic. It's in addition to the few biomarkers we have, knowing something about changes in pancreatic size might be an additional feature that we could use in diagnosing or dissecting heterogeneity or following longitudinally. And that's what the study is about, because the authors of this study have developed a very standardized protocol using magnetic resonance imaging for measuring pancreas size and shape. And they've used this protocol in a significant cohort of patients with either new onset type 1 diabetes or long-standing type 1 diabetes. And importantly, they've done longitudinal measurements of both size and shape in these folks and tried to make correlations between that and such things as disease duration. So that's the background to the study. And I'll hand it over to Chase to you to tell us about the methods they used.
Thanks, Ashok. That was really helpful to understand what's going on here. And Taylor, thank you as well for some of that background. And we'll come back to both of you as we go through the methods here. And as we usually do, we're going to think about the study design that's used here. I think it's a helpful way of understanding what exactly the authors do. And I think the best way to describe what the authors use, the inferential method that is employed, is that of a prospective cohort study. As a reminder, we've looked at a lot of these, but cohort studies work by having a group of individuals that you can then subdivide into at least two groups. And those groups are defined based on the presence of an exposure. And in its simplest form, you have one group that is exposed to something and another group that is not exposed, that is unexposed. And then what makes it a cohort study is that you follow those individuals over time. They did not have any outcome when you started, but you follow them over time to see if one group versus another develops an outcome at a different frequency. And then what makes it a prospective study is that you start the study before the outcomes have developed. You are following these individuals in real time. You're going along with them to see when that outcome develops. And the real strength of a prospective study is that you get to define exactly what it is that you want to look at. A lot of these cohort studies are retrospective, and while those are much easier to do because all the data exists already and you were just going back and collecting it and analyzing it, you have very little control over what data you have access to. It's just whatever exists in the database, whatever you can pull out of notes or whatever it is, somebody else's research study, that's the data you're going to get. Prospective studies are great because you get to decide what you want. Now, the flip side of that is in biomedical research, anything that takes time takes a lot of money because you got to follow folks for a while. So they are not easy to do, but they are ideal for an observational design. So that's what's done here. Now, let's think about this study much more in depth. The number of individuals with type 1 diabetes was 91. So they had a good amount of subjects here. And you could further divide that group, the individuals with diabetes, into two different groups. So the larger group were those who had new onset type 1 diabetes. 56 of those 91 had recently developed type 1 diabetes, recently been diagnosed with it, and with a mean time since diagnosis of 66 days. The other subgroup in this type 1 diabetes group were those who had long-standing type 1 diabetes, 35 such individuals. And the mean time since diagnosis for them was 26 years. So for many of these folks, this was very long-standing diabetes. We're going to come back to that in just a second. There was a control group, and that was 90 individuals. They were of a similar age to the individuals with type 1 diabetes, but the controls did not have known pancreas pathology. And of note, another thing we're going to come back to here in a second, is that 40 of those 90 individuals were first-degree relatives of those with type 1 diabetes. Okay, if you have a few questions we need to wrestle with here, and I'll start with Ashok. So normally, Taylor, as our guest expert, would get bothered with all of these questions, but this question I'm going to ask is actually Ashok's area of expertise, where he's a world expert. So it's very logical to ask him, and he was the one who pointed this out as we were doing an analysis of this article. But Ashok, walk us through the implications of what it means to have type 1 diabetes, and in particular, in this description, this method, there's not a real clear indication of how they knew these individuals had type 1 diabetes. And often we assume, or we have reason to think that, but as a lot of your work has uncovered, there are many people who we think have type 1 diabetes that maybe actually have some other form of diabetes. So how could that happen? What does that look like? And then what implications might there be for this study?
So, you know, a lot of things are done in terms of method description and papers simply with the authors trying to fit the length requirements. So often you don't get all methods described. But it was concerning to me that one of the fundamental biomarkers that one uses to define classic autoimmune type 1 diabetes, which is the circulating autoantibodies, you know, were not routinely measured in these patients, and they were not used as a criterion for defining type 1 diabetes. So one presumes that the type 1 diabetes was defined in clinical terms, probably on the basis of somebody with strong clinical evidence of complete or near complete lack of insulin and requiring lifelong insulin treatment. And even if that's the case, the problem with using that as a definition for type 1 diabetes is that you automatically introduce the notion that it could be very heterogeneous. So there could be at least four classes of people within those they're defining as type 1 diabetes. There would be those that are, in fact, classical, typical, have evidence of the autoantibodies and are completely insulin requiring. There could be those that have absolute requirement for insulin longstanding. They don't have the antibodies, not because they never had them, but because, as we know, over time, some proportion of patients lose all of the three or four classical antibodies that we measure. A third category could be patients who, you know, have a different form of autoimmunity that is not manifested by these traditional well-known markers of humoral autoimmunity. They could have some form of cellular or other kind of autoimmunity for which we don't have currently a biomarker to measure. And fourthly, the one that really is kind of the extreme end of this heterogeneous form of complete insulin deficiency type of diabetes would be somebody who really doesn't have islet autoimmunity as the basis of their insulin lack. It could be some other metabolic factor or genetic factor or various other things that are currently of great interest to people looking at heterogeneous forms of diabetes. So not having that and lumping everybody into a class of type 1 diabetes, you know, already introduces some imprecision in what it is you're going to measure. What if even the criterion or the parameter they're using, which is size and shape, what if that were different depending on the kind of pathophysiology? Some might be continuous, therefore you might have continuous change. Others might be stable, so you don't have continuous change, but it starts off smaller. There's a whole variety of different things. But having said those things and having put those caveats out there, as a beginning foundational study, I think this is terrific, Craig, because it's going to show us at least for one imprecisely defined form of diabetes, what happens? And I think the results are quite significant. So I haven't wandered too far from the topic, but those are my thoughts on the subject.
Very good. Yeah, that is definitely helpful for us to keep in mind as we move forward. Okay, now, Taylor, you'll be on the hot seat for a couple of questions here. And one of them is one that you alluded to already, and that's about this idea of a preclinical phase in type 1 diabetes. So the authors report in days what the mean time is for when the individuals with type 1 diabetes, this new onset, for how long they'd had it. But we know that actually the process starts much sooner than you actually develop symptoms and clear clinical manifestation. So give us some sense. I know you mentioned already there's a lot of heterogeneity. There's going to be a lot of variability, but give us a sense of how long might this autoimmune process have been occurring in the pancreas by the time these folks are actually diagnosed with having diabetes?
From the perspective of pediatric endocrinologists, you know, I come at this as most of the patients that I see are children who are diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And birth cohort studies show that many of these islet autoantibodies appear in the first year to 5 years of life. And certainly we know that the younger that you develop islet autoantibodies, the sooner you'll progress to type 1 diabetes. And so probably a limitation of the study is that you can't put a younger child in an MRI scanner without sedating them. And so this is a study that looks at older kids and young adults, which probably have a different progression or length or duration of preclinical islet autoantibodies compared to a child who progresses pretty quickly. So I don't have a precise answer of how long these people have been developing type 1 diabetes because that's so variable from person to person. Younger children progress quicker and young adults or older teenagers might have several years before they're actually diagnosed with new onset type 1 diabetes.
Great. That's helpful. And I have a follow-up question for you then about the control group here. And I was interested that so many individuals who were first-degree relatives of folks with type 1 diabetes were included. And I was interested, what might the impact of that be? What are your thoughts there, particularly since we don't know for those individuals, for those controls, if what their antibody status was, is it possible that they are going to develop type 1 diabetes in the future? It hadn't manifested yet, so they don't have known pancreas pathology, but maybe they will in the future. So what thoughts do you have on what impact that might have?
I wonder if the authors just didn't comment on where these relatives were recruited from, because frequently just the nature of recruiting for some of these studies is that you have a kid with type 1 and you recruit their first degree relatives into monitoring and progression studies. So it's possible that some of this autoantibody data is available for some of these people, but they didn't comment on it in this paper. But I would think that being a first-degree relative of someone with type 1 diabetes, we know those people have a higher risk of also themselves developing type 1 diabetes. So certainly that will influence the way that we interpret this data in terms of knowing that these people are at a higher risk than the general population, so not a true general population control.
And I was thinking about this, and I think it's hard to know for sure, but likely even if you did include a few individuals there who had very early stages of type 1 diabetes, if anything, this would actually likely blunt the effect that you're going to see. And Ashok's going to walk us through the results. I won't steal his thunder, but they did see a difference in these two groups despite that. So if anything, if they had excluded those folks, maybe would have made the difference more dramatic. But I think they saw a clear difference despite that. It's good. And so a few more comments here in the methodology. And with the imaging that was done here, so there's an evaluation in the group of individuals with type 1 diabetes. So 53 of those individuals had these measurements that we'll talk about shortly done every 6 months for as long as 5 years. So that was that longitudinal component and very intensive as far as imaging goes. And the technique, Ashok mentioned it already, but this was done with MRI, and they followed a technique that was called the MIPAV, the Medical Image Processing Analysis and Visualization Criteria. And I hope that Taylor could maybe give us just a little bit of an insight. So very few of us are likely to have much understanding of exactly how this is done. So Taylor, just from a very high level perspective, help us understand a little bit about how this imaging works and what information you get when you do these serial cross-sectional MRIs.
Yeah, so I'll have to speak to this from the perspective of a pediatric endocrinologist and definitely not a radiologist. But what I thought was really cool about this multi-site center technique is that they published earlier, and I was involved in this project earlier as well, standardizing that the way that they use their MRI machines. And so what we actually did is we sent people all around the country with the same pancreas, obviously, and then used different MRI machines across the country to standardize the way that we measured the pancreases. We also had a model of a pancreas. One of the authors on this paper made a 3D model of his own pancreas and then used that in the scanner to make sure that we could harmonize and standardize these MRI machines from center to center. And so that's the most that I can speak mostly about MRI in terms of how they get these images. But what I think is really cool about it is we were able to standardize the way that we access the images to compare patient to patient, and so that the data is comparable from center to center.
Yeah, and we'll talk about this at the end. I think there are several really notable strengths of the study and why this is such important work that's been done. But this may be the highest. It's certainly up there. And I think just to build on that, not only the technique and that's standardized so that can be done at multiple different places, but another comment that they made that I really like was just being careful so the radiologist who looked at these was blinded. And I think this is important because in these sort of studies, if you're not careful, if somebody who's evaluating the outcomes knows which group somebody is in, it introduces the possibility of an ascertainment bias, and it's just a natural thing. If you know what someone's exposure is, then potentially you could look at that a little bit differently. We like to think about imaging as being very objective, but I think as we know from clinical care, there is definitely a subjective component to that. So I thought that was a really helpful inclusion from the authors that that the radiologist was blinded, and so we don't have to worry about the possibility of ascertainment bias on that end. A few comments about glycemic control measures. So information was obtained from the patients, and this could be a combination of patient-reported information or data that was obtained from the electronic health record. And the authors looked for data about DKA, about what the most recent A1C was, about total daily insulin use, about C-peptide and autoantibody status. And for some of these individuals, 24 of the individuals with type 1 diabetes, they actually had CGM data available. And I'll note one other thing here, not likely to be a big concern, but always something you have to think about is when patients are being asked to recall information, particularly if they know more about what their exposure is or what their outcome is or any of these other things that they're looking at, they can potentially think about some of this other data differently. A recall bias is what that is, that they think about their exposure differently based on whether they know what the outcome is. And so it's unclear how much of this was based on patient recall versus EHR data. So could have an impact here since most of this is going to be a bit more objective data from the MRI. I don't think it's going to have a huge impact, but at least there's a possibility of that there. Okay, so I think those are the key points that we wanted to make in the method section here. And I will now hand things back over to Ashok to walk us through these important results that were described by the authors.
So there were sort of four kinds of results that were reported. The first was the longitudinal results on the size of the pancreas in those that had newly diagnosed diabetes and were followed over some length of time. The second category of results are in those who had previously diagnosed type 1 diabetes, and that was the cross-sectional results in terms of size. The third was an assessment of the shape in addition to size, and how do the two correlate was kind of the fourth point. And so I'll go over each of these. So in terms of the 53 new onset type 1 diabetes patients who had longitudinal data, the mean follow-up was close to 2 years. And the way in which the data was accumulated and presented is presented as volume, and it's divided into proximal and distal volumes. Or it's described as a volume index, which is basically the same volume adjusted for body weight. And basically, the pancreatic volume, regardless of proximal or distal, declined in the first year of follow-up and then didn't change very significantly. So, and if you looked at the volume adjusted for body weight, because body weight changes over time in these younger patients, again, there was a decline in the first year and then a much slower decline over remaining years. And it turned out the decline, the rate of decline, was fastest in those who had the largest pancreas volume index at the start. And very importantly, there was an inverse correlation between the pancreas volume index and what is described as the low blood glucose index, which is a CGM-derived parameter. In other words, the smaller the volume index, the higher the risk for hypoglycemia is what this correlation revealed. The second set of data had to do with the cross-sectional data. This is in the folks that had who had the long-standing type 1 diabetes. In these patients, the pancreas volume correlated with age until the second decade. And thereafter, the pancreas volume and age were inversely related. So this is different because in the non-diabetic controls, again, there was a correlation between the pancreas volume with age until the second decade, but it was stable thereafter. In other words, in those with type 1 diabetes, there was a decline over the first 20 years, presumably, of life, when you look at it cross-sectionally. And then, you know, as you got older, the volume decreased. Whereas with the control subjects, although it changed because they were getting older, in the first 20 years after that, it was stable, meaning there was it pretty much correlated with growth or lack of growth. So that's quite important. And in terms of looking at it in terms of the shape, it turned out that a thinner pancreatic shape was associated with having type 1 diabetes, or a larger surface area to volume ratio correlated with having type 1 diabetes. And then they go into 10 quantitative variables that have to do with characterizing the three-dimensional shape of the pancreas. And they look at these variables in the persons with and without type 1 diabetes. And the bottom line is that all aspects, all 10 variables, ended up with a smaller size and a smaller shape and a different shape in patients with type 1 diabetes. And one sort of general outcome that clinicians might follow was that the loss was more in the width of the pancreas than in the length of the pancreas. So the pancreas ended up sort of getting thinner if you looked at it head on or horizontally. And the controls always had a larger pancreas size as well as a fuller shape than the patients, but also more than their first degree relatives who were at risk for type 1 diabetes, which kind of comes to the point that Chase was making earlier and Taylor as well about what is the role of the autoimmunity happening in the pre-type 1 diabetes stage. Then in terms of the relationship between size and shape, it's pretty complicated. And they came up with a model that is based on both the size and the shape. And they were able to use that model also to predict a difference between patients with type 1 diabetes and the control patients. And finally, they really didn't find any correlation between any of these visualization parameters and the insulin dose or the C-peptide, the hemoglobin A1C.
So yeah, now we're going to really think about this and then we're going to dive into a couple of these in depth. First of all, though, I want to start by recapping the authors do this and then at the very beginning of their discussion, the five main findings that they have. So number one, pancreas size declines most rapidly during the first year after diagnosis with type 1 diabetes. Number two, the pancreas size is inversely correlated with disease duration in individuals with longstanding type 1 diabetes. Three, the shape of the pancreas is altered at diagnosis with diabetes, type 1 diabetes. Four, the pancreas is smaller in individuals with a genetic risk for developing type 1 diabetes. And five, the pancreas volume is correlated with individual risk for hypoglycemia. We're going to think about a couple of those in more depth here. And the first one is that decline in size. So the authors make a few helpful comments, I think, here. So when they talk about potential explanations for that initial decline in size, they comment on a couple of things. So the one is the individual difference in size is that, it's possible that those who had larger pancreases had just more to lose, that may be the explanation there. And then also that it could be the timing of diagnosis, that those with larger pancreases were diagnosed earlier. And so maybe that could be an explanation. And then they go on to comment about some other potential explanations or underlying mechanisms for the ongoing decline. And they speculate that it could be related to local insulin deficiency, that ongoing inflammation could be playing a role here, or that there could be other metabolic disturbances that are driving this. So Taylor, I thought it would be helpful for you to give us some insight. The authors are speculating that they say we don't know for sure, but these are some ideas. You do a lot of work in this space. So what are your thoughts based on what the authors have proposed and what else we know from the medical literature? Which of these seem to be the most likely explanations for what we're seeing here in these changes in size?
Yeah, I think it's really hard to know, right? It's probably multifactorial, but I think we just still don't have a great explanation for how to merge endocrine and exocrine issues in the pancreas. And what I thought was really interesting about this paper is that they really can't show any correlation with diabetes outcome and C-peptide production. So just because the pancreas is smaller, doesn't influence how much insulin you're needing or how much C-peptide you're still producing. So it's possible that it's some kind of combination in acinar tissue to beta cell islet crosstalk or environment that is contributing. So that's where I would probably put my weight or money in terms of local inflammation in that area, decreased tissue around the islet. We know islets really need great vascularization in terms of islet health. So it's possible that if the acinar tissue around the islets is declining, then perhaps vascularization is also declining. That's one place that I'd start, perhaps. But I think there's still a lot to be gained in terms of understanding why this is happening and how they affect each other.
Yes, I agree. It seems to open a lot more questions than we had before and really starts pointing us in more directions, showing us, as often these studies do, how little we understand and how much more we need to try to understand what's going on here. Okay, so one other thing I thought was really interesting, and I'll leave this with another question for Taylor, but first of all, it's the risk of hypoglycemia. So the authors again point out that risk is correlated with the pancreas volume. And so they try to provide some potential explanations for that. And one, Taylor mentioned it already, is that maybe it has to do something with the exocrine function here, is that maybe what we're seeing is a loss of exocrine function, and that then affects fat and protein absorption, and that's the big driver for that risk of hypoglycemia. Alternatively, this just could be related to more advanced beta cell dysfunction. The problem with that is, Taylor mentioned this already, is that we don't see clear connections to those different markers, C-peptide, for example, that would clearly indicate that these individuals have more advanced beta cell dysfunction. So, Taylor, thoughts on that, of those explanations? Which do you think is more likely or potentially something else unrelated to that that's driving that risk for hypoglycemia?
Yeah, what I also think is really interesting is, you know, as endocrinologists, we don't typically measure markers of exocrine deficiency. So our gastroenterology colleagues will measure fecal elastase to help them understand what's going on in the exocrine pancreas. But we don't do that as endocrinologists. Future studies and other studies that are going on right now using MRI are also collecting fecal elastase. And I'll be really interested and excited to see if we can find any correlation in those future studies that are going through TrialNet at this time. But yeah, I think another aspect that could be influencing this is if we're seeing the most pancreas volume decline in that first year after onset. That's also the time of the honeymoon period when blood sugars are more labile, people are still producing their own C-peptide, and often they're also having multiple hypoglycemic events as their own endocrine function is still kicking back in. So possible that the honeymoon could be contributing to that hypoglycemia that they're seeing as well, and that those people who have the smaller pancreases and the more rapid decline then are having more hypoglycemic events. But I think there's still a lot to be learned in this aspect too.
All right, so now we're going to move into the author's conclusion. We're going to keep wrestling with some of these things that we've already talked about. So first of all, to quote the authors here, they say that the size and shape of the pancreas are altered in individuals with type 1 diabetes and exhibit progressive changes with longer diabetes duration. And then another conclusion or final comment from the authors, again, to quote, these findings support the idea that there is a dynamic interaction between the endocrine and the exocrine pancreas that is disrupted in type 1 diabetes. And so now we're going to think about a couple different things in a second. We'll get to where we need to look in the future. Does this need to change what we do now, either in clinical care or in research? But before we get to that, I just want us to think about the quality of this report overall. And Ashok, let's start with you. And what are your thoughts? Just quality of this report, how did this strike you? You mentioned a few things already, but why don't you circle back to that for us?
Well, I think it's the culmination of long and very difficult work. I mean, everything that Taylor described in terms of standardizing this protocol and running it through cross-sectional studies, you know, is a major effort. And then to put it together in a longitudinal study has all of the difficulties for a longitudinal study. And while I did criticize them initially for the definition of type 1 diabetes, studies like this are very hard to recruit for, especially if you want to be able to measure things over and over again. I mean, doing it every 6 months in a substantial number of the folks with new onset diabetes is quite a feat, even if it's a multi-center study. So I think that, you know, given the difficulties there, the degree of rigor is actually excellent. And fortunately, I mean, issues such as sample size you know, may have played a role. They may have played a role in such things as the lack of correlation with the glycemic parameters and C-peptide, et cetera, et cetera. But at least if their major outcome was to try to find if size varies with having the disease or not having the disease, I think they managed to find enough people to do that. So I think that that really is quite a major accomplishment. And I think that in that sense, you know, I think it's a very fine paper and it's a foundation for now going on to see different types of diabetes. I should mention maybe somewhat with some trepidation that I understand that the same group in collaboration with folks who work on monogenic diabetes have actually tried to track the same parameters in patients with a couple of the common forms of monogenic diabetes. And if I'm not incorrect, there is a recent publication or one about to come out, which shows that, in fact, the same thing is the case there as well, which raises the whole issue of, is it the autoimmunity causing this, you know, or is it simply the presence of diabetes, or is it just a common genetic factor that's affecting both? There are many, many more questions, as Taylor said, need to be answered. But bottom line is, I think this sets a very nice foundation, besides which it's nice to have another biomarker for the disease, which it seems that there is.
Good. Taylor, let's get your thoughts. And one thing I'm interested in particular to hear your thoughts on are this connection, and particularly that the authors indicate that they think these findings support that, as they describe it, a dynamic interaction between the endocrine and the exocrine pancreas. It's maybe a little surprised to hear that because, as you mentioned, at least in this paper, in this study, they didn't measure any of the function of the exocrine pancreas. So so maybe comment on that, but just also your thoughts about the quality of this report overall.
Yeah, I mean, for that point, I think that's a great speculation in terms of how the endocrine and exocrine pancreas are interacting. We just don't have any biochemical evidence of that, but we just don't have a way to measure that either at this point as clinicians. So I think it's a great idea, and more can be gained from more basic science studies, mouse models, et cetera, and trying to understand the interface between endocrine and exocrine tissue. But we can't discern that essentially from this study, but I think we can certainly speculate about it, which is still inspiring to me. Overall, I think it's a really good study in terms of the large sample size, the fact that they're able to study multiple people longitudinally for a long time from multiple centers, and having been involved peripherally at our own center, just recruiting people for these studies is pretty difficult. People struggle to be in MRIs. It's challenging to get this information. So it's certainly quite a feat to get all of this data together. I think there's a lot more that can be gained and added into these investigations in terms of pairing with biochemical markers, following for a longer time, sorting out more in terms of genetics or islet autoimmunity from patient to patient. So I think it's an exciting beginning of utilizing an additional biomarker or clinical marker that we can use for understanding the progression of type 1 diabetes.
Good. And let's stay with you, Taylor, and we'll have you wrap things up for us here today. So help us understand, probably not ready for prime time yet, but as we think about the future, how might this actually be useful, not just for understanding disease, but actually potentially treating individuals? So thinking about, could this be a marker for the risk of developing type 1 diabetes or what progression looks like, particularly now that we actually have a medication that could be used to delay the progression of type 1 diabetes? So help us understand that, maybe if not now, how might this information in the future be used to actually drive clinical care?
I think in the future, this could be an additional excellent tool for understanding progression and prediction of type 1 diabetes. So right now we're really limited to islet autoimmunity and the biomarkers that we have, but hopefully one day in the future, someone can come to us with their genetic information, their pancreas volume, and we can really give them an idea of if they will progress, and if so, when they might progress to type 1 diabetes, and then who are the people that would best benefit from intervention in terms of delaying onset of type 1 diabetes or preventing onset of type 1 diabetes. So hopefully we can use MRI in the future as a tool to further define heterogeneity, stratify risk, and intervene to eventually prevent people from developing type 1 diabetes.
And with that, I would like to thank Ashok Balasubramanian and Taylor Triolo for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope that you learned as much as I did and that you will join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of the Endocrine Society, with production oversight by Brandy Brown and Andrew Harmon.